From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The mass shooting in Las Vegas last night was utterly terrifying. Concertgoers out for a night of country music on the Strip suddenly caged targets for gunfire raining down above from above in the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. This hour On Point, what happened last night in Las Vegas? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the terrible scenes from Las Vegas? Were you, are you there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Let's go right to Las Vegas and Joe Shaneman, senior producer for KNPR. Joe, thank you very much for being with us today. We're sorry for what happened in your city last night.
Thank you, and you're welcome.
Can you please describe to us the physical relationship of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino and the field, the concert area?
Yeah, Mandalay Bay is to the west of the Las Vegas Strip. The concert area is across the street on the east side. It's basically, it was a vacant lot. It was someplace where they're going to put up a huge sort of like Ferris wheel a couple of years ago that was abandoned. So it's several hundred feet away from where the shooter was.
Now, the shooter, who has been identified, of course, is Stephen Paddock, the 64-year-old from Mesquite, Nevada. He was on the 32nd floor and
32nd floor.
And in a room that he had taken at the resort.
Yes, and he's dead now. He shot himself, police have said, and apparently he had the room rigged with cameras so that he could see if police were approaching. Several other weapons, police are saying, were found, but some of the details on that are still scant.
In excess of 10 weapons, 10 rifles, we're hearing from police. I want to stick with this relationship again for a second and what kind of angle the fire would have been coming down on this vacant lot from. So you're saying a few hundred feet, yards, what, from the resort to the concert site?
Yeah, it's not he was apparently from the sound that I've heard, and I haven't gotten this confirmed from Metro Police, it sounded like an automatic weapon. And the people were very densely packed into a fenced-in area listening to a country western concert. So from a high angle, shooting just sort of, it seems, sounds like randomly into the crowd.
Here's the sound of that gunfire erupting as the singer Jason Aldean performs during the country music festival in Las Vegas last night. Just astonishing volume and rapidity of fire right there, and that coming down apparently from a lone shooter in the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. Can you describe the scene there for us as you've seen it, heard it recounted, and seen it replayed once the fire began, Joe?
Now, understand that this happened close to midnight. I wasn't there. A lot of us in Las Vegas didn't find out about this until early in the morning. But from video that I have seen, people sort of were standing, not knowing what it was. It does sound a bit like firecrackers. People have testified to that fact in recordings. I think people just...
Did not sound like firecrackers to me, I have to say, right there, as we just heard it. That sounded like automatic gunfire.
Some people were saying they thought it was firecrackers.
Sure. Like
some of the video, they're just standing there. I'm like, what's going on? They weren't sure what was happening.
And then, I mean, we're reading these reports of people just dropping all over the place. People kept dropping and dropping. People were getting shot 1 foot away from us. This is someone talking with MSNBC, Megan Kearney, who was there. People were trying to save their friends. There were gunshots everywhere. Helping them would have meant that we got shot, too. Describe that scene as you've seen it.
There are people started scrambling and pushing down the fences to get out. And there are rumors of spreading, and somebody did say this on a television program for the TV news here, that a woman was in the crowd before the shooting telling people that they were all going to die. I think Metro Police is looking for that woman or has found her. That's still up in the air.
Is this supposed to be the woman who they're looking at who is associated with the shooter?
I can't say with any degree of certainty to that, but it sounds like that. Now, there have been reports that the person was already contacted and released. But that was, though, from some newspaper out of England. So I really, right now, still in the information gathering process.
This Mary Lou Danley, we understand they were looking for early in the morning, and more to learn on that front. The death count has just kept climbing. Here was Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo this morning saying the death toll in Las Vegas would continue to grow.
The deaths associated with this event to be over 50. I can't give you an exact number yet because we're still investigating some of the areas involving the event where the concert was taking place, and we're still exiting individuals that were hidden.
And you hear just how much confusion there's been around this, but the numbers have grown and grown, Joe. And I think that sort of speed of the growth in those numbers has been kind of shocking in itself. You start out at one number, pretty soon it's more than double that number. By any count, it is the worst mass shooting in American history now. But those numbers were fluid in this early morning, Joe.
Yeah, well, a lot of people, you know, up to 200 people or more were injured, some critically taken to the hospital, and I'm just assuming, you know, some of those people didn't make it.
Here's Gail Davis, attended the concert last night, said the scene was gruesome when the chaos erupted.
There's people laying everywhere. People were bleeding. One guy was holding his girlfriend or wife or, I don't, woman, and he was crying and saying, "Oh, God, baby, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. It's my fault." And I think she had been shot in the head because he was just covered with blood, and we ran.
Joe Shaneman is with us from KNPR in Las Vegas, and we are trying to get our heads around what unfolded there with bloody terror in Las Vegas last night. Lots of listeners paying very close attention to all this from afar. Josh in Richmond, Vermont is on the line. Josh, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to start by saying that I'm a former infantry officer, served in an infantry training center way back when. And, you know, I agree with you. That was automatic gunfire. Anybody who's heard it would know that. And I'd like to make two points. The first point is that all of the gun rights people talk about the Second Amendment. And you know, and I both know, that when the Second Amendment was written, there were no weapons like this available. It was muzzle loaders that could be fired one
sure.
or two rounds a minute, not what we heard. And obviously the solution that the gun rights people keep denying is the availability of high-capacity magazines. And we could hear this morning that this, you know, what happened last night was this guy was emptying high-capacity magazines into that crowd. And there's no reason for anyone to be able to fire a gun like that in a civilized society. So those are my points, and, you know, I think you agree with me. I know there are people who don't agree with me. But those are the points I'd like to make as somebody who's had some experience with these weapons.
A former infantry officer listening to that fire. I mean, we will get more detail, but the sound of it is the sound. It appears to be the sound of automatic fire. Joe Shaneman in Las Vegas. I mean, here people are going to, once again, this will come right to the fore. What is the gun ownership pattern in Vegas and around it? Is I mean, you got plenty of gun shops there.
Yeah. We're a pretty high gun ownership state. I'll be honest with you. At this point, 7 hours after the shooting, I don't think people are really talking about that here as much. I do understand your caller's view. But it's early to be talking about that right now, but yes, gun shows happen here quite frequently. Gun ownership is pretty high, and it's an issue that does come up a lot here.
Here was the country singer Jake Owen telling the Today Show about what he saw at last night's concert, the gunfire.
You hear it ringing off the tops of the rafters of the stage. That's when you saw people fleeing, and at that point, everyone on stage just started just running everywhere possible. And it was pretty chaotic, for sure.
Joe Shaneman is with us from KNPR in Las Vegas. Joe, at the site of the concert itself, was there anywhere that people could take shelter?
No. I know the site just by having driven by it. It's basically a great big open lot. There's a stage at one end. People go in another end or from different entrances. There was no shelter. There wasn't anything to hide behind.
And egress or getting out of there, we know that people pushed down the fences. Did that happen quickly? Do you know what the timing of that was? How long were people trapped under this fire?
I'm assuming within minutes, but I honestly, I don't have those details right now.
They're talking about escalators being around there somewhere. Do you know what that would have meant? People trying to get into nearby hotels, I guess?
There are escalators, but I would say maybe an eighth of a mile to the north, going between Excalibur and the Tropicana. But immediately by the site, I'm not sure.
Are people just going wherever they could to try and get out of there and
right.
not sure where the shooting would end? Here was eyewitness Julia Owen talking with the Associated Press about what she saw.
People were running up the escalator and saying, shooter, shooter. So we went into the Guinness store, I believe, and we were kind of in their dressing room and hiding because we were very afraid that there was somebody there.
Joe Shinran, it's a very large crime scene at this point. What's the situation at the resort?
If you're trying to go to Mandalay Bay, I would say don't even try to right now. It's probably surrounded by police. The area, they just opened I-15, which is the major highway that goes that runs parallel to the Las Vegas Strip. That was just opened a couple hours ago. So it's still, I mean, this is, like I said, only 7 hours after the shooting. I would say it's chaotic. There is an extremely high level of security on the Las Vegas Strip. There are literally probably thousands and thousands of security cameras there. It's probably one of the most secure places, you know, in the country.
One might have thought. That can hardly be said this morning.
Exactly. I totally agree with you.
And the hospitals there, this is a terrible load.
Yeah, we have one level one trauma hospital, which is University Medical Center. They're taking the brunt of the serious cases. Some of the people are being shunted off to the other hospitals, and then the serious cases from there are being then shuttled over to University Medical Center, which is in downtown Las Vegas.
Joe Shaneman, senior producer at KNPR in Las Vegas, and we are looking at the worst mass shooting in American history. It unfolded last night at a country music concert in Las Vegas. Joe, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound there from last night when the automatic gunfire rained down on the country music concert in Las Vegas. We now know this was the worst mass shooting in American history, and that is a history, especially of late, that is way too thickly populated with mass shootings. We're looking at what happened last night, the scene there, and what is unfolding this hour. You can join us. Everyone is looking at the footage from that terror last night. People not far from the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, the shooter on the 32nd floor there, now identified as Stephen Paddock, 64 years old, from Nevada, Mesquite, Nevada. Authorities saying more than 10 rifles found in his hotel room there, and the fire rained down. Fences pushed down by people desperate to escape. A very high death and wounded tolls here. 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. What do you see in the video coming out from last night, in what we're learning about what happened last night? 800-423-8255. We just come from Las Vegas. I want to go right now to Adam Langford. He's a criminology professor, expert on mass shootings, social deviance, criminal behavior. Joins us from the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. Adam Langford, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
We know that there is much that remains to be learned here, but I'm sure you're taking this on board, as we all are today. What are your first thoughts on what we have apparently witnessed in Las Vegas?
Well, certainly there are a lot of different angles we could look at this from, but I think, you know, what jumps out, of course, is what you said in terms of the number of victims. And, you know, I think of this kind of in two ways. On the one hand, the average American's chance of dying in one of these things is infinitesimally small. On the other hand, the trajectory looks terrible. It's not only the worst mass shooting in United States history, but the four deadliest shootings have all happened since 2007. Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Orlando. You know, at Orlando just 16 months ago, we were saying the same thing, worst shooting in U.S. history. So the trajectory here in terms of how these things keep getting worse, and frankly, the evidence that it seems like these offenders learn from each other and try to one-up each other, that's a very scary thing to consider.
You've been, no doubt, watching and listening to the description we've just heard about the physical layout there and the apparent angle of the shooter's fire on this crowd. What are you thinking about the logistics of what happened last night, Adam?
Well, I think a few things. One is certainly parallels can be made to the 1966 tower shooter who also attacked from an elevated position, and the victims were unfortunately kind of overwhelmed.
You're talking University of Texas.
Exactly right.
Though in that case, the victims were spread across that kind of parkland around the tower. Here they are crowded into what became a killing zone.
Yeah, it certainly did. That notion of kind of attacking from an elevated position is really kind of a well-established military tactic, although it doesn't appear that this offender had military experience. He certainly prepared and planned this out carefully. And I guess the one of the really concerning things here is that, you know, at campuses like mine and all around the country, average citizens have been told, run, hide, fight. Run, hide, fight is your action, how to respond in something like this. And because of the nature of this attack, the idea of fighting back against this offender, you know, throwing chairs or tables, trying to tackle this offender, sometimes that works, but it couldn't work here because of the design of the attack.
The shooter was at some distance from the crowd. Clearly, the fire was lethal at that distance. Does that tell you anything about the likely weapon or weapons?
Certainly it would suggest that the offender, which we already know, is not just kind of shooting with a pistol. That distance, you know, frankly, it's something that modern technology and modern firepower can easily overcome. But I guess the other thing I would point out about the distance is there's a tremendous amount of research on kind of the normal human psychological resistance to killing. In other words, the idea that generally human beings don't like to kill each other, and we have some resistance to that. What is unfortunate is that distance seems to mitigate that. In other words, it's typically easier for people to kill from a distance than it is for them to kill up close. Up close, you know, you're in the midst of it, your conscience may set in here a little bit. You may start to feel overwhelmed by the moment. At a distance, people are more likely to kill and more likely to kill effectively, and I think that's what we saw here.
Are you surprised at the death toll? I mean, the numbers have just kept rising today. First, we heard more than 20. Then we heard 50-plus, 400, more than 400 wounded. And these numbers, of course, may climb. Are you surprised?
Well, I think in any one given incident, you know, if I had to bet, I would say probably the number of fatalities and the number of casualties would be lower. But when we think back to Orlando, well, one of the reasons that was such a deadly incident was because it took so long for the police to get to the offender and stop that threat. And here, I think we also saw a situation where, you know, the offender couldn't be tackled. The offender didn't just immediately take his own life. So the incident was going to keep going until someone could stop it.
And the sound of that fire, can you interpret it beyond apparent automatic weapons fire? Does it say anything more to you? We played it a couple times just so people could, and it's hard to hear, and we hate to play it. I mean, we hate to have to report this whole thing, but can you hear something informative in it, Adam?
Right. Well, I mean, I hear what you hear, that it sounds like automatic or at least semi-automatic gunfire. There's a lot of people who kind of aren't familiar with that, you know. But also, I think, you know, no one thinks this is going to happen to them, you know. And arguably, that's one of the biggest problems in this country in terms of sparking real change, that, you know, people think that this happens to someone else. It doesn't happen to me. It doesn't happen to my loved ones. And that kind of denial is often still present in the opening moments of a shooting like this.
We've got the brother saying there were of the shooter saying there were no warning signs. And yet, here we are. You say the density of these attacks is growing. The curve doesn't look good. And you said the shooters appear to be learning from one another. What and again, we acknowledge that just in talking about it right now can be part of that learning curve, and that is and we hate that. On the other hand, we have to be aware of what's happening. How do you see that learning taking place, Adam?
Well, it happens in a variety of ways, and I guess I would say you're right that talking about these things, you know, can be part of the problem. On the other hand, you'd like to think that society is learning too. The scary thought would be if the offenders are learning from previous attacks and we're not, which is unfortunately what it seems to be. So you can think about learning in various ways. I've looked at a number of these mass shooters who have specifically studied and cited previous shooters. So that's part of the problem. But also they simply learn of the idea to commit these shootings in the first place. This is not some sort of thing where it's just like an inevitable form of crime. You know, it's not just acting on impulse. It's not like, those like inherent human sins. It's not like lying or cheating or stealing. These are offenders who have a grudge, but they also have a lot of role models, essentially, for how to respond to this kind of grudge and how to do it in a major way that makes media headlines. So there's really kind of a recipe now for getting attention, going out in what these offenders often refer to as a blaze of glory, and the fact that they are able to gain those lessons about getting what they want is part of the problem.
Is there a profile here? I mean, clearly the ages are very different. If you look across this span from, from Sandy Hook to Las Vegas, but I suppose there could still be common denominators. Can you see them?
Sure. Age, you know, is the easiest thing to write down, you know, and to track because it's you know, so objective. But first of all, I think most obviously we'd say that these offenders are almost always male. More than 95% of them are male. But beyond that, the suicidal element is a major, you said that the brother said there were no warning signs. Well, you know, frankly, I would beg to differ. Unfortunately, that's what we often hear after these incidents, at least, right after them. But the suicide...
Well, you know, that's a brother who, I mean, he may be right that he didn't see anything, but he also, nobody wants to be associated with having seen stuff that you didn't mention, or must be embarrassing to say, gosh, you seemed pretty on edge, but I didn't know what to say about it or do about it.
Right. And not seeing the warning signs is not saying that, it's not the same thing as saying that they weren't there. Some scholars have said we're kind of in a suicide epidemic in the United States in general. Suicide rates are almost at a 30-year high. Unfortunately, in a lot of those cases, you know, if we were so great at identifying suicidal desires in advance, we wouldn't be in the midst of this larger national problem, let alone the murder, suicide, and the mass shooting problem. But yes, there absolutely are warning signs in these cases. You know, the fact that this guy potentially planned this for a long time, you know, it's terrible because that planning probably contributed to the deadliness of this attack. But that planning is actually a window for intervention and prevention. That was a lot of time that he was thinking about committing this attack, and someone could have intervened.
But you've got all kinds of people in this country who stockpile weapons at this point, and they can share all kinds of reasons for that, you know, that... Lord knows, you know, sort of people who think there's some coming apocalypse they want to be ready for. How do you know the difference between someone who's, you know, planning something as lethal as this potentially, and somebody who's just frightened or in love with the idea of having an arsenal?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the most critical thing is that suicidal element, which is, if you have all the guns in the world and you care about your own self-preservation, you would never do something like this. You know, for your listeners, they can go to the National Institute of Mental Health and look up risk factors and warning signs for suicidal behavior. And frankly, if we look, you know, I don't know what's going to come out in this particular case, but in a lot of these cases, the individuals tell someone what they're planning in advance. So the U.S. Secret Service did a study of school shooters. They found that 81% of school shooters told at least one person what they were planning. We know that the Orlando shooter told his wife. The Charleston church shooter told a friend. So I wonder whether, you know, in the coming days we'll find out that someone had an inkling of what was going on. If it wasn't the brother, it might have been someone else.
Here's the brother, Eric Paddock, brother of the shooting suspect, Stephen Paddock, telling CBS News his brother was not an avid gun enthusiast, he thought.
The fact that he had those kind of weapons is just, where the hell did he get automatic weapons? He's not, he has no military background or anything like that.
But here we are, worst mass shooting in American history. Tracy, calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Tracy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I just wanted to say that I can't believe that we're still, even at this moment, at such a horrific thing, are having people break this down into a race thing. And I work with a bunch of, I'm African American, but I work with a lot of individuals who are Caucasian. And a lot of things that they're saying is they can't believe it happened at a country music festival, or the guy didn't have a terrorist sounding name, or Fox News is already reporting it's not a terrorist attack. And it just amazes me how many people are in a box and how many people are getting their thoughts from Fox News. It's, I just can't believe this is a horrible thing that has happened to these individuals, and to be trying to play it again as a race thing is just unbelievable.
Tracy, I appreciate your call. Adam Lankford is with us, criminology professor, expert on mass shootings at Tuscaloosa University of Alabama. Adam, there are clearly stereotypes that we've thrown over. The idea of terrorism here or mass shooting, you know, Tracy's there in Atlanta hearing coworkers express surprise it's at a country music festival, or that it's a white guy named Steve. Do these surprise you?
No, not at all, actually. So I guess I'm a little surprised by her perspective, because a lot of people have the perspective that these shooters are almost always white. Either they're white, or that they're people who kind of embrace or attracted to kind of an Islamic fundamentalist perspective. I have looked at the race of these offenders, and about 63% of public mass shooters are white. So that's pretty much, you know, exactly the number of, or the percentage of white people in the United States.
Give me that percentage again. 50 what?
It's about 63%.
63%. Okay, so just about.
Right. It's pretty much representative of the population as a whole, but white public mass shooters, you know, in terms of other types of homicide, it's one of the types that white offenders commit more than other types of murder.
Neil in Burlington, Vermont. Neil, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Hi. I wanted to comment on this this topic of discourse around these public mass shootings versus terrorism. I mean, I think when it is a white person, it's a public mass shooting. But I already read this morning that it's a lone wolf, that it's not terrorist. And I think this divide around if this person did have a name associated to Islam, this would be a whole different discussion. This conversation might be focused around ISIS. Are they here? Is it this? Is it that? But oh no, it's just another white person. So here we go again with another public mass shooting, but not terrorism.
Neil, let us take it right there. It's short before the break. Adam, we have heard officials even today say, no, it's, if you've got that many people being shot and that many people that terrified, it's terrorism. How do you look at it, Adam?
Well, certainly we can look at terrorism as an act, as, you know, we can apply a definition of terrorism. We can say it's premeditated. Is it ideologically motivated? Is it intended to intimidate or coerce the public and things like that? But, you know, something a lot of people don't know is that a lot of these terrorist incidents, quote unquote, are actually very personal as well. So the Orlando shooter, he didn't know that much about terrorism, actually. So, you know, I would be hesitant give too much credibility to any of these offenders just because they claim an ideology. Usually they have deeply personal problems, and that's the root of why they do what they do.
It's weird. We don't want it to be terrorism. On the other hand, we want or look for some sense in it that the word terrorism seems to suggest. We're looking at a terrible mass shooting, terrorism or not, you decide. Adam Lankford is with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the worst mass shooting in American history last night in Las Vegas. I've been joined by Adam Lankford, expert on mass shootings, criminology professor at the University of Alabama. News keeps coming in, among other things. This morning, we saw a jump in the stock prices of gun manufacturers in this country, kind of a terrible indicator in itself. Stephen Paddock, we're told, 64-year-old from Mesquite, Nevada, allegedly the shooter, died at his own hand. At least 10 rifles, authorities are saying, found in his room in the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. That fire just raining down on a crowd packed in not far below his 32nd floor perch there at the Mandalay Bay. And the death toll extremely high. First number this morning, 20, more than 20, then more than 50, more than 400 injured. And those numbers, of course, with capacity to grow. Adam, I want to ask you about our national reaction to this. I mean, as you say, the rapidity of these, the frequency of these has grown. Now we've got the biggest numbers ever. What about the national reaction? Are we reacting in a rational way, in an effective way to what we're seeing? Or what would an effective way be?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly there are a lot of different elements of the reaction. You know, it's not like all Americans do the same thing or make the same decisions or have the same opinions. The stats you quoted on basically the potentially renewed or heightened interest in firearms after something like that, it's interesting because after some previous mass shootings, there was a surge in gun sales, and people said, the reason people are buying guns is because they're afraid that President Obama is going to take their guns away. But what this seems to suggest is that, it's actually a much more kind of visceral reaction, which is they just want guns to protect themselves. It's not about like concerns about the political system cracking down on their guns as much as just wanting guns for protection. Is that rational? Unfortunately, absolutely not. Very few of these things are ever prevented by citizens who have guns. And, you know, we talked about the rising rates of suicide in the United States. The fact is, if we have more guns in this country, that's going to lead to more suicides, more homicides. I actually did a quantitative study where I looked at shootings from all around the world, mass shootings from all around the world, over more than 40 years. And I found a clear, statistically significant association between the number of firearms owned per capita in countries and the number of public mass shootings. So that was not an opinion study. That was just a direct statistical link. So I guess my sense is I'm worried about people who are afraid taking steps that will actually make them and make the country more in peril in the future.
Craig in Omaha, Nebraska. Craig, you're on the air with Adam Lankford. Thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Okay, first off, I want to say all these shootings, I don't care if it's mass shootings, singular shootings from gangs or whatever, they're all tragedies. But what my take on the whole thing is the society in this country has been broken down. I'm gonna give you a couple examples. Okay, I'm going to take a handful of people. I'm going to call them the Supreme Court. They're not gods. They're human beings just like everybody else on this planet. But yet they can make a law that says you can kill your unborn. Okay, then we have another handful of people. We'll call them the Congress. They say that, yeah, we're going to take our young. You've never had a quarrel with nobody in this country, but we're going to send you over there to either kill or be killed. I mean, there's so many examples. Cigarettes, okay? Tobacco. people's got to smoke it. But why do we let manufacturers put a known substance called nicotine, which is addictive, into this substance?
Craig, we've got it. Let me take it to Adam Langford. Society's breaking down. You must hear that when you think and write and talk to people about mass shootings. I mean, very often that's the response. You know, the feeling that and you heard our Omaha caller's version on it, but society's breaking down. Society's breaking down. Is that what's happening here, Langford? What do you make of that?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I would go a different way than the caller on this. First of all, certainly there are a lot of things about our country. You know, there's a lot of political anger. There are a lot of problems like that in terms of, you know, breakdown of the family, divorce, all these kind of things. But other countries have those problems as well, and some countries have them far worse than we do, actually. So if you looked on a kind of comparative basis, country to country, you know, again, you know, frankly, the stats just say it's the difference is firearm availability, not these other social factors. But I would say one thing that I think is particularly concerning is, and I've written about this some in the past, that there does seem to be a certain kind of entitlement among Americans, and particularly among young Americans, although the offender was older in this case, where people really feel entitled to a certain level of success and are quick to lash out if they don't get it. So I guess there were some initial reports with the offender last night that he had sued a Las Vegas casino in the past and failed to win that lawsuit. And there is kind of a common theme where people, you know, who commit these public mass shootings have some sort of failure in their life. And instead of kind of just dealing with it or recognizing that, hey, life's not always fair or sometimes things go against you, they lash out in these violent attacks. And I think there is something in terms of kind of social values that is problematic in that fashion.
And so here we are, where you're out at a concert and suddenly there's complete mayhem and you don't know what's going on. You don't know if you're wounded. You don't know if your friends are wounded. Here's Joseph Ostuño. He was there last night in Las Vegas. He told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that his friend was wounded during the shooting, didn't even know it right away.
It was chaos. And we fled the venue. We literally hopped over a gate to get out. And my friend kept complaining that something had happened to her, and I'm like, and I felt her body, and I didn't feel any wound whatsoever. And then we got to the place that we were going, and we checked her again because she kept complaining, and we found a wound on her right shoulder.
Go to a concert, run, don't know if you're wounded or not. You are wounded. What a scene. Here's a concert photographer saying everyone backstage last night first thought the sounds were technical problems with the speakers. You can imagine that, but not for too long. After they realized the sounds were bullets, they ran. Here he is telling CNN about it.
So we're exiting off stage, and we're going around the stage towards the right, and people are just, like, climbing all over the fences trying to get out, and people are just screaming again, and then you just hear pop, 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 pop. It was like, I mean, it sounded like 50 plus rounds was just going off.
Picture it. Picture it. It is utterly terrifying, and it's in our country right now. Tom in Tampa, Florida. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. I think, obviously, I don't know man or any of the circumstances, but to me, it highlights a looming problem in this country, in that you have older people in the baby boom generation, millions of them, who are unfortunately going to get dementia and Alzheimer's and mental disorders of old age, and there are going to be millions of guns owned by people who are in that condition. And maybe this man had a mental problem of age, maybe didn't, but I think it's a problem that we should face. I'm 68.
Yeah.
And when I can't drive a car anymore, they won't let me drive. But if I have a gun, I can keep it forever.
Adam Langford, what do you say? Boomers going off their rockers. A tidal wave of problems here, or is it all ages?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, I think, first of all, mental health problems absolutely do play a role in these types of attacks. But I would link it more again with suicidal behavior. So certainly we do see elderly people engaged in suicide, you know, for a variety of reasons. Looking at the age of these offenders, often you see kind of two peaks. So you see some of these offenders in what can be referred to as a quarter-life crisis in their 20s or 30s. And then you do see some offenders who are later in their 50s and 60s as well.
And grief.
Adam, stand by. Let's go to the president speaking in the White House this morning.
In a large crowd at a country music concert in Las Vegas, Nevada. He brutally murdered more than 50 people and wounded hundreds more. It was an act of pure evil. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security are working closely with local authorities to assist with the investigation, and they will provide updates as to the investigation and how it develops. I want to thank the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and all of the first responders for their courageous efforts and for helping to save the lives of so many. The speed with which they acted is miraculous and prevented further loss of life. To have found the shooter so quickly after the first shots were fired is something for which we will always be thankful and grateful. It shows what true professionalism is all about. Hundreds of our fellow citizens are now mourning the sudden loss of a loved one, a parent, a child, a brother or sister. We cannot fathom their pain. We cannot imagine their loss. Families of the victims, we are praying for you, and we are here for you. And we ask God to help see you through this very dark period. Scripture teaches us the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. We seek comfort in those words, for we know that God lives in the hearts of those who grieve. To the wounded who are now recovering in hospitals, we are praying for your full and speedy recovery and pledge to you our support from this day forward. In memory of the fallen, I have directed that our great flag be flown at half-staff. I will be visiting Las Vegas on Wednesday to meet with law enforcement, first responders, and the families of the victims. In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one, and it always has. We call upon the bonds that unite us, our faith, our family, and our shared values. We call upon the bonds of citizenship, the ties of community, and the comfort of our common humanity. Our unity cannot be shattered by evil. Our bonds cannot be broken by violence. And though we feel such great anger at the senseless murder of our fellow citizens, it is our love that defines us today and always will, forever. In times such as these, I know we are searching for some kind of meaning in the chaos, some kind of light in the darkness. The answers do not come easy. But we can take solace knowing that even the darkest space can be brightened by a single light. And even the most terrible despair can be illuminated by a single ray of hope. Melania and I are praying for every American who has been hurt, wounded, or lost the ones they love so dearly in this terrible, terrible attack. We pray for the entire nation to find unity and peace, and we pray for the day when evil is banished and the innocent are safe from hatred and from fear. May God bless the souls of the lives that are lost. May God give us the grace of healing, and may God provide the grieving families with strength to carry on. Thank you. God bless America. Thank you.
The president this morning at the White House heard the sound of a woman who fled during the shooting, got choked up as she told KLAS how she found other concertgoers hiding under her car for shelter.
Everyone's telling us to run, run as fast as you can. My husband and I ran out toward our car, and there were people hiding underneath my car for cover. And there was a gentleman that was shot, and he said, "Can you help me?" And so I put him in my car, and I had like six people in my car, people with shoes, running just to get away. And
chaos last night in Las Vegas. Adam Langford at University of Alabama, what did you think of the president's remarks to the nation there? An act of pure evil, and him calling the speed of the law enforcement response miraculous.
I think those are pretty standard things to say. He also said there are no easy answers, which of course he's right. At least he's right in that maybe they're not politically easy answers. I would say, and I think the research backs it up, that the implementation of changing guns in this country would be difficult, but the clarity with which we know that gun ownership is part of this problem, that is quite clear. So I guess I'm not surprised that he didn't mention that, but it would have been a terrific surprise if he had.
Adam, do we have to live with this? This is getting really bad.
Well, frankly, I like what you're saying there because, I hear some indignation, right? Do we have to live like this? Do we have to put up with this? And the answer is, no, we don't. But we need more people to get, frankly, outraged about the current state of things. We don't get change just from hoping things change and not being willing to invest in changing the underlying conditions, changing the number of guns in this country, being more proactive in terms of intervening in people's lives, saying as many people say, well, there's nothing we could have done. There were no warning signs. That's not good enough.
Adam Langford, we are very grateful to you for being with us today. We cannot just treat this like the weather. Adam Langford, criminology professor at the University of Alabama. Listeners, thank you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.